Today on Wings, the conclusion of our Juneteenth special, Wade in the Water, by Afro-American historian and storyteller Marion E. Barnes. Juneteenth is a new national holiday in the United States, celebrating freedom from slavery. But as Marion Barnes explained, few people want to know about the 300 years of cruelty imposed upon the enslaved. Her story, Wade in the Water, is based scrupulously on historical sources. It includes shocking but accurately depicted words and descriptions of some of the forms of cruelty slaveholders used to impose their will on captives. If you don't want to know, stop listening until 28 minutes have passed.
We need to remember.
Storyteller Marion Barnes.
This week, after Queenie moved into Platt House, word came that Moses was coming to lead an escape from the area the night of the new moon. Every day, the songs of captives singing in the fields spread the word. Steal away, steal away, steal away.
There's a river of birds in migration. A nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration. A nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today's Wings program continues the story Wade in the Water, written and performed by Marion Barnes. The characters so far are Queenie, a 10-year-old enslaved girl.
Queenie's frightened eyes stretched wide and filled with water. They were laughing and talking about a price for her like she wasn't even there. Marse Josh rubbed his thick, heavy, hairy hands all over her 10-year-old child's body, just showing the first slight signs of coming womanhood.
Platt is the pedophile slave owner who purchased Queenie.
She's built little, so she ain't never gonna be no strong worker. But you take me, I'm a single man. I'm gonna need somebody to run my house for me again pretty soon. Maybelle ain't even 20-year-old yet. But seem like she ain't got no strength, no life like she used to have.
Johnson is the slave owner who sold his own daughter and separated her from her twin brother, King.
Well, listen, ain't but 10, and you squawking about the price, you old hound dog. For what you got in mind, she'd be cheap at twice what I'm asking.
Johnson's cook resolves to help the young girl escape.
You hush, little queen, the cook said. She wiped Queenie's face with her apron, then pulled her close. It'll be all right. Trust me, child.
Hap Hat, short for Happy Hattie, tells Johnson's field hands what is going on in the house, using song.
Hap Hat set her basket on the ground, withdrew a clothespin, and pinning a shirt on the line, she began to sing mournfully. Without a father, without a mother, without a sister, Lord, or a brother, what a mean world to live in. Lord, I've got to live here until I die.
Uncle Ezra wishes to prevent Platt from sexually abusing Queenie, and he prescribes herbs that make the child seem gravely ill.
When asked about her, the old man would shake his head as though dumbfounded. Never saw nothing like this in all my born days. Nothing I give her ain't helping.
Maybelle, a victim of Platt's sexual enslavement, resolves that Queenie shall not share her fate.
Someone else would replace her in Platt's bed. Someone else would have to stand his pawing, clawing, jawing all over her body. She had not cared who that would be. She would be free of the horror, and nothing else mattered. Now, the sorrow of her soul was for herself and for Queenie. Slowly, she lifted Queenie's little hand in her own hands, now rough, bony, and claw-like. And she remembered the first night she had spent in this house, when her hands had been like Queenie's were now. From that moment, she guarded the child fiercely, managing to always have herself or someone else in the room with her.
Wade in the Water, written and performed by Marion Barnes. As the story reopens, the enslaved captives are singing. Their songs, borne on the air from one plantation to another, include a coded message. Harriet Tubman, their Moses, is coming.
Word came that Moses was coming to lead an escape from the area the night of the new moon. Every day, the songs of captives singing in the fields spread the word. Steal away, steal away, steal away. The old man's a-coming for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow, follow, follow the drinking gourd. The gospel train's a-coming, get on board. Little children, get on board. Little children, get on board. Little children, there's room for many a more. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way, praise God, I'm on my way. With the first alert that Moses was coming, the medicinal herbs being given Queenie were changed. You just fine, little queen, Maybelle told her as she became more alert. We keep you so Platt won't bother you. But you ain't never been in no danger. Uncle Ezra made sure you eat good food, and I move your limbs around plenty every day. Moses soon coming now, and we getting you ready to go north. But if anybody excepting us knows you as well, she warned sternly, they might slip up and let Platt get a hold of it. Despite urging from Cook and Uncle Ezra, Maybelle was not among those planning to escape. I'm not strong enough, she said. I'd hold the others back. Uncle Ezra was not leaving. Too old, too old. These bones too old to make that journey now. Anyway, he added, I got to stay here because I'm teaching Smiley what I knows about healing, so our folks here will have somebody can help them after I'm gone. The night of the new moon fell dark and silent, with no moonlight to illuminate movement or shadows, no rain to make traveling difficult, no damp earth to preserve telltale tracks. In the morning, after what seemed a perfectly normal night to the captors, captives were missing from every plantation in the area. The escape was not detected immediately. At the Johnson plantation, the morning had seemed routine until horsemen from neighboring plantations raced onto the grounds, their animals lathering, and shouted that there had been an escape. Any of your niggers missing? They called to Johnson. Help me get a head count, Johnson yelled. The riders rapidly scattered across the plantation, calling to the drivers in each field, count your niggers, some of them escaped last night. Johnson was relieved to find none of his hands was missing and thought, I know how to treat niggers. That's why none of mine run away. Nevertheless, in neighborly concern, he joined the riders as they headed for Platt Place. Joshua Platt had awakened that morning in an evil temper, viewing the young captive who had shared his bed with disgust. Forcing whiskey on her all night had been useless, changing her from stiff, quick and scared, to loose, stupid and scared as she was now, her huge, frightened eyes glued to his face. Platt planted a foot in the middle of the girl's body and shoved. Her slight form sailed off the bed and thudded to the floor. The impact burst the blisters on her buttocks made by the heat belt. The heat belt was a strip of heated metal that banded across the mattress and anchored in fire pots on each side of the bed, and this was used to force captive women to move their bodies during sexual intercourse. She pulled herself up painfully and stood crouching, arms clutching her body to dull the pain. Her dewy eyes searched Platt's face, not knowing if he meant for her to go or if he was beginning another round of pleasure. "Git," he said, and watched her hobble out of the door. Later, unshaved, head pounding, eyes angry and red, he went to Maybelle's room to check on Queenie, as usual. He flung the door open and faced Maybelle standing between him and the girl's form on the bed behind her. "How's that gal this morning?" he shouted. Maybelle looked over her shoulder toward the bed as though afraid his voice might wake the child. "If she's sleeping, she don't need no damn bodyguard," he bellowed. "She half dead and you half dead sticking over her like a buzzard all the time. I'm tired of you hanging in this room day and night. Don't do nothing for your keep. I'd sell your nigger hide down river if I could find a fool would buy it." He smashed the open door against the wall and lumbered down the hall and out of the mansion. Platt was mounted surveying his fields when the riders dashed onto his property with news of the escape. "None of your niggers gone, is they?" For a brief moment, his eyes were questioning. Then his jaw slacked as if he'd been struck. Spinning his horse around, he dug his spurs into the animal and galloped headlong toward Platt House, the party of puzzled plantation owners at his heels. Something was wrong at Platt House. The certainty crackled through Platt's body like a bolt of lightning. He had known it talking to Maybelle earlier, but his whiskey-dulled senses had failed to alert him. Now, with the pounding of hooves of his horse singeing the earth and kicking up spurts of dirt behind them, he remembered Maybelle's face that morning, expressionless as a mask. She had been waiting for him to open the door, and the door had been closed, defying his order that it be kept open. As the horse thundered up to the front porch, he lifted his eyes and saw Maybelle standing statue still, watching him from her window. Flinging himself from the horse, he dashed into the house and tore up the stairs, John Johnson right behind. Inside the room, he lurched past Maybelle, seated quietly, and ripped the cover from the form on the bed, exposing pillars and a bolster. With a hoarse roar, he lifted Maybelle from her chair by the collar of her dress. "Where is she?" he rasped, the words scarcely intelligible. "Where is she?" "I don't know," Maybelle whispered. His fist struck her mouth and blood spurted on his hand. "Where is she? Where is she?" he roared again and again, smashing his fist into her face each time he repeated the question. Then Johnson was pulling him away. "Come on, Josh. She ain't gonna answer you. Let's go back to my place and talk to the twin. I took a head count of all the field niggers," he worried out loud. "Wasn't thinking about no chillin' round the house and house niggers. If that gal's gone..." Sure enough, when the children on the Johnston plantation were counted, Lil' King was missing. Then it was quickly discovered that the cook and Hap Hat were also gone. Johnson was enraged. "Let's get after 'em. They can't go far, taking that sick gal." In addition to the local patrols, always on the lookout for escaping captives, Johnson, Platt, and the other owners formed an emergency posse, taking bloodhounds from each of their plantations, dogs barking and yelping, nosing the ground and straining at their leashes, men shouting and cursing, horses galloping furiously. The riders took off, their dogs following the scents of the escapees. Even before they left, the field hands began singing, "Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's a-gonna trouble the water." The song was a message to the escaping captives. "They are chasing you with bloodhounds. Get away from the land and wade in water so the dogs will lose your scent." Nobody knew where the runaways were. But airborne from the hands on one plantation to those on another, the refrain traveled northward, crossing the dividing lines of states. Somewhere along the way, the fleeing captives heard the musical message and took to the water. Afraid, tired, and hungry, they also learned from the melody how to recognize Underground Railroad supporters prepared to help them. "See those children dressed in white? They must be the children of the Israelite. Why don't you wade in the water? Wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's a-going to trouble the water. After 4 days, the posse returned empty-handed, the owners livid. Accused of knowing about the planned escape, captives were whipped. Already meager food rations were reduced. Work hours, always grueling, were increased to compensate for the missing hands, and virtually non-existent privileges were revoked. Josh Platt went immediately to Maybelle's room. It was empty. In a howling rage, he demanded information of one person after another. Nobody could tell him anything. "All right," he screamed through foam-rimmed lips, eyes dancing madly. "Get them dogs out again. She can't get far, dumb, half-dead nigger bitch. I should have sold her years ago." This time, the dogs plunged forward, following a single trail that led to the riverfront not far from the house and a small, neatly folded pile of Maybelle's clothes. The animals pounced into the pitiful lump of clothes. There was the sound of ripping fabric, scuffling, yipping, a brief moment of circling and nosing the ground. Then they picked up the trail again, dashed headlong to the edge of the river, and stopped. Baying, whining, circling, Maybelle's scent had disappeared. Shrieking a stream of curses, Platt laid his whip about on animals and human beings alike. His subsequent questioning of captives proved futile. Who had seen Maybelle? Who had talked to her? Had anyone seen her talking to anyone else? No one admitted knowing anything. The enslaved captives at Platt's place were not as sure of Maybelle's end as Platt seemed to be. In quiet whispers, they questioned each other. Had Maybelle taken off her clothes, waded into the water, and drowned herself? Or had she left the clothes there as a decoy, put on other clothing, and made her way north on her own? No one knew the answers. In the fields, workers began to chant in a woeful minor key. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God is going to trouble the water. Meanwhile, on the next plantation, incensed by evasive answers and bewildered facial expressions, Johnson was lashing out at Uncle Ezra. "You lying boy, I know you lying. You and that cook was thick as thieves. Ain't no way that gal could have been as sick as you've been saying she was. She couldn't have traveled out of here with that bunch and stayed in them woods 4 days without being found. And you know something about why them dogs couldn't pick up no scent from them nigger women that left here. I believe you give them something to put in their shoes to throw the dogs off. Well, they may be gone, but you here. Boy, you here. And you're going to get the whipping of your life. Jake! Jake, get over here!" He was calling the most savage among the drivers who beat the captives. When Jake arrived, Johnson had a change of heart. "No, no!" He snatched the whip from Jake's hands. "I want Smiley to do it." Smiley was a gentle soul, strong and strapping. Johnson had bought him 3 years earlier when he was 12. He was an unusual boy. His skill with plants and animals was unfailing, as his love for nature and people. Uncle Ezra had found in him a perfect understudy, and for 3 years he had been teacher and father and friend to the boy. Now, at the whipping grounds, tears were streaming down Smiley's face. Johnson was set on making him whip the old man while the other captives watched. Uncle Ezra's body was swinging from a pulley on a crossbeam between two posts. Following Johnson's orders, Jake had drawn Uncle Ezra's left foot up and tied it toes down to his right knee, making the left knee a handle with which to turn the body. At the resting level of the dangling right foot was the sharply pointed end of an oak stake or stob that had been hammered into the ground. The trussed position of the old man had stretched the skin of his back until it was shiny, making it easily cut by the whip. "When that nigger start whirling round, he gonna put his foot on that stob to stop hisself," Johnson told the crowd. "And when he stop hisself, one of you other niggers that's by that knee handle, grab it and spin him round on that stake. And if you don't, you gonna get from my whip what Smiley's giving him with his whip." With that, he shoved Jake's whip into Smiley's hands. "You in charge now." "Oh, please, massa, please," Smiley pleaded. I can't. "You just think you can't, Smiley. I'm going to help you. Every time it looks to me like you thinking you can't, I'm going to give you some help." Johnson swooped his split-end whip down on Smiley's bare shoulders and back. The multiple ends of the whip snaked themselves around the boy's sweating skin, then slithered off reluctantly, leaving a split welt for each tongue of the whip. "But why me, Massa? Why me? I don't want to whip nobody." "You, because I say you. You gonna whip that nigga till I get tired. I'm gonna make sure him and you and every nigga on this place knows I'm master here. He ain't never gonna get out of his place and think he gonna outsmart me no more. He ain't never gonna get out of his place and think he gonna outsmart me. Oh, but Massa, I can't. Don't tell me what you can't do, boy. Start whipping that nigga now, and I don't want to hear no more from you. And if I do, I'll put you up there in his place. And when I cut you down, you still gonna have to whip him." As he spoke, he struck Smiley with his whip again and again until the boy's back was a crisscross mass of bleeding welts. His face awash with tears, Smiley began the flogging. Coached by Johnson, he laid on 5 lashes from Jake's bullwhip at one time, then waited for a moment for Uncle Ezra to come to and catch his breath, as Johnson ordered. At first, the groans and shrieks of the old man could be heard over a mile away, but as the punishment went on, they died into a scarcely audible moan. Several times he tried to steady his twirling, nauseated, pain-racked body, placing his foot on the pointed stake. Immediately, by a touch of his whip, Johnson selected a captive to grasp Uncle Ezra's knee handle and spin his body around, driving the point of the stob into the sole, heel, or ball of his foot all the way to the bone. When the torture had gone on for an hour, and there were no sounds or signs of life from Uncle Ezra, Smiley appealed to Johnson again. "Please, Massa, he's gone down. He's done gone down. He can't feel nothing now." In answer, Johnson laid into Smiley with his whip. "I'm not tired yet. You just keep putting that whip to him. I'll let you know when I'm tired." When at last Smiley was allowed to help cut Uncle Ezra down, the old man's back was a clump of lacerated flesh and blood. The flesh of his wrist had been gouged out by his bonds, and the sole of his foot had been pierced to the bone in 3 places. The oak wood was stained deep from the blood that had streamed from his foot, and beneath the beam where he had hung was a pool of coagulated blood. As Smiley carried Uncle Ezra to his quarters, Johnson called after him. "Don't you be forgetting to wash his back and foot in salt water and red pepper. Do, I'll have you swinging and twisted on that gallows next." Uncle Ezra tried to open his eyes and closed them quickly. The blurred, twirling walls of the room came swirling into him. Nausea swelled up from the pit of his stomach, and he was spinning. He did not know what had happened to him or where he was or how long he'd been where he lay. An hour, 2, a week, a month? He did not know that Smiley had bathed his body, which he could not feel or move, with soothing herbs and water. He did know that Smiley was with him, and he knew that Smiley was not smiling. He also heard the song being sung by captives nearby. "I am bound for the promised land. I am bound for the promised land. Oh, who will come and go with me? I am bound for the promised land. Smiley, he whispered. Smiley. Smiley put his ear to the old man's lips to catch the words. You hear that singing? Another train leaving here, going north. Please, 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 get on it. Please, please.
Storyteller Marion Barnes.
Wade in the Water is based on the lives of people who once lived. I learned their stories by talking with formerly enslaved persons during my childhood, and with elderly members of my family, and by consulting the library records of the United States government-sponsored interviews with formerly enslaved people conducted by writers in the 1930s. The legacy of slavery imprints upon the life of every African American from birth to death. Forgetting the past means living with the imprint, and not knowing what caused it, nor how to counteract it or benefit from it as the need may be. We need to remember. An estimated 100 million Africans were kidnapped from their homeland and sold into captivity. And it is believed by many historians that of that number, more than 30 million were slaughtered or died of maltreatment or disease. We need to give tongue to their every wound. The American Holocaust of enslaved Africans lasted nearly 300 years. It is impossible to number the millions of men, women, and children who were whipped, tortured, hanged, butchered, and roasted during those centuries. We need to remember. The death-dealing afterglow of the Holocaust in which we now live continues to claim lives daily, directly and indirectly. We need to remember. We need to remember. We need to remember.
This story was recorded for Marion Barnes by Frieda Worden in Austin, Texas, at WATER, Women's Access to Electronic Resources, a project of Genevieve Vaughn's Foundation for a Compassionate Society. The recording is copyright by Marion Barnes, 1996, and released in Wings by permission of the author. Marion Barnes died in 2012 at the age of 89. Her publications include Black Texans, They Overcame, a series of three anthologies of African-American stories headed Talk That Talk, and 12 Steps to Bringing Out the Best in Every Child. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found through the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.